If John Perry Barlow ever wrote a resume, and he's probably not the type who ever has, it would list 17 years of cattle ranching in Wyoming, a few decades of writing lyrics for the Grateful Dead, experimenting with LSD alongside Timothy Leary, and co-founding the Electronic Frontier Foundation. But science fiction author Bruce Sterling once named Barlow's primary profession as that of a poet, in the sense that Percy Shelley once described poets, the unacknowledged legislators of the world. When Barlow stood behind the podium at the Icelandic Digital Freedom Society's conference at Reykjavik University the summer before the country's banking collapse, the stubble-jowled rancher looked more like a Western priest, wearing a black leather jacket over a black shirt, a black kerchief tied into his collar, and a white cross emblem above it. The sermon he offered the assembled Icelandic technophiles was a people's history of communication, from the invention of language to the first printing press, a device he argued had launched a renegotiation of power that led to everything from the 30 Years' War to the Spanish Inquisition. A half millennium or so farther down his timeline, Barlow came to his own discovery of the Internet. "And lo, I typed in Telnet," he said, "and I could make a hard disk spin anywhere in the world. I had a real holy vision at that point," he continued. "If you're going to take all of humanity and put them in the same social space where they don't have clothes or buildings or anything to show who they are, they don't have property, they don't have jurisdictional boundaries, they don't have law. Maybe it could be the biggest thing since the capture of fire." The Internet represented another renegotiation of power, he argued, one just as dangerous to the status quo as Gutenberg's invention had been. For the next 25 years, he and fellow cyber libertarians like John Gilmore and Lotus founder Mitch Kapor would spend much of their lives and enormous sums of money fighting the governments and corporations that would seek to neuter or restrain that new social space. Birgitta Jonsdottir was in the audience, and it was one tossed-off idea near the end of Barlow's speech that lodged in her mind. "My dream for this country," he said, "is that it could become like the Switzerland of bits." He didn't elaborate. When I visited Barlow in his Chinatown apartment in New York a few years later, he was more explicit. "I had thought about the Pirate Bay a lot, and I wanted something more robust than that," he said between drags of a Marlboro cigarette and sips of Red Bull. He had even discussed the Transparency Haven idea with a government minister in Monaco before thinking of Iceland. "I felt like the answer to sovereignty was sovereignty, to fight them on their own terms." A few months later, Jonsdottir was elected, and then the final ingredient in Barlow's idea appeared. WikiLeaks came to Iceland. It began when Bogi Austsson, a Walter Cronkite-ish anchor for Icelandic national broadcaster RÚV, appeared on the evening news and calmly explained that a legal injunction had prevented the station from airing a prepared exposé on Kaupthing Bank, the biggest bank in Iceland. Instead, he said, viewers should visit a site called WikiLeaks, where they could see the source material for the TV segment themselves. Icelanders who took Austin's advice found a newly leaked summary of Kaupthing's loan book posted on the site, detailing an ugly web of more than $5 billion in loans from Kaupthing's coffers to its own proprietors and companies they owned, with little or no collateral. $2 billion, for instance, went to the bank's main owners, brothers Aust and Leithur Kuthmansson. Another billion went to Olafur Olafsson, a major investor in Kaupthing, who had on his own birthday flown in Elton John from England along with a grand piano for a one-hour concert. The banks had been eaten from the inside out, says Kristin Hrafnansson, a former investigative reporter in Reykjavik who had worked on RÚV's blocked report and later joined WikiLeaks as a spokesperson. A government inquest began pulling apart the documents to determine if Iceland's anger could be channeled into criminal charges against Kaupthing's executives and others. 11 men, including billionaire brothers Robert and Vincent Cengiz, who both took loans from Kaupthing and also held an investment stake in the bank, would eventually be arrested in London and Reykjavik. Neither the Cuthmanson brothers nor the Cengiz brothers were indicted. But Olofsson, the Elton John fan, faces charges of money laundering, and his prosecution is ongoing. WikiLeaks immediately became a household name in Iceland. And just 3 months later, Julian Assange and Daniel Domscheit-Berg arrived in Reykjavik, conquering heroes from abroad. They were invited to appear on the talk show of Ekil Helkesson to discuss their bombshell bank leak. Two idealistic young men, unable to suppress goofy grins on cameras as they basked in some of the first mainstream attention to their work. Afterward, strangers on the street offered them hugs and bought them drinks in bars. It was on the set of Helgeson's talk show that Assange reintroduced a long-smoldering idea, a blend of his love of Neal Stephenson's Data Haven novel, Cryptonomicon, his recent work digging into the internals of the Cayman Island holdings of the Swiss bank Julius Baer, and Barlow's seed of an idea from his talk a year before. "You mentioned to me this idea that in Iceland we should become a vanguard of publishing freedom," Helkesson, a cheery round man with blonde curls, said to the pair of WikiLeakers in their on-camera interview. "Absolutely, absolutely," Assange responded. "We see in the Caribbean islands and the Cayman Islands that politicians create laws to enable offshore financial institutions to hide the assets of the developing and the developed world," he said. "Iceland could pull off the opposite trick," he argued, "transforming itself into an island where nothing is hidden." He went on to list the world's most liberal freedom of information and media laws from Sweden to Georgia. "Why not pull all this together and become the center for publishing in the world?" 2 days later, he and Domscheit-Berg spoke at the same Digital Freedom Society conference that Barlow had keynoted, fleshing out the idea with an even longer list of possible laws Iceland could cherry-pick and emulate. Jónsdóttir spoke at the same conference, and when she left the university building for a cigarette break, Assange introduced himself and said he would join her outside in a moment to smoke a cigar. When he came out the door, he was, instead, carrying a hard-boiled egg, which he ate without explanation. "That's the strangest cigar I've ever seen," Jónsdóttir deadpanned. They liked each other immediately. 2 days later, Jónsdóttir brought Assange and Domscheit-Berg to a late-night meeting with a group of activists at a Reykjavik tapas restaurant. Not to dream any longer about a transparency haven in Iceland, but to strategize about how to actually build one. For the next months, Immi commanded the activists' lives. Rob Hongrap, an old Dutch cypherpunk friend of Assange's and a longtime member of the Chaos Computer Club, flew in to help manage the research. Smári McCarthy, a half-Irish, half-Icelandic free information advocate and hacker, taught himself to read the legal codes of countries across the Western world, culling and tweaking a list of laws the group had compiled. By February, the small group had a proposal ready, one that tasked the Althingi with researching and voting on a series of bills over the next years. One dark winter evening, Jónsdóttir read that call to action into the parliamentary record before a sparse crowd of legislators. "It is hard to imagine a resurrection of our country from financial ruin and widespread corruption due to secrecy. But we intend to offer a business model based on transparency and justice," she said. "We will be the first in the world to market ourselves as a country with a principled, holistic, and modern set of laws fit for the digital age." The proposal passed unanimously. Immi had taken on a life of its own, but Julian Assange had other work left to do in Iceland. A few weeks later, Jónsdóttir and Assange were sitting in the English pub, a quiet cafe across a courtyard from the Althingi. Assange asked Jónsdóttir to watch a video, and he turned his laptop screen toward her. Typically unaware of his surroundings, he had left the volume on full blast without headphones, and a waiter walked over to shush him. Jónsdóttir looked on as a helicopter circled a group of men on the streets of New Baghdad. Then, as it showered the figures with bullets as they ran for cover. Then, as it fired again on what remained of their bodies. Then again, on the family of bystanders in a black van who tried to help them. And sitting in the middle of that Reykjavik cafe, Jon's daughter openly wept. Later, as WikiLeaks set about tearing two wars open for the world to see, she would think of the poem she had written before the invasion of Iraq in 2003. These are images we should put in a frame, mount them in our homes, so we never forget the true horror of war. Zlatarov Street in Burgas is a quiet, tree-lined strip of cobblestones just a few blocks from Burgas Park and the beach. It takes its name from a Bulgarian chemist and novelist who famously worked to protect the country's Jews during the Second World War. At 7 p.m. on December 20, 2007, the sun had already set, and most of the street's lampposts were in disrepair, leaving the sidewalks nearly dark. Yordanov was walking to his apartment along that peaceful lane when a man in a black ski mask turned swiftly from a gated alleyway on his left, blocking Yordanov's path. He barely saw the figure in time to jump backward instinctively. The man's knife darted toward Yordanov's chest, cutting through his coat, his sweater, and the skin of his torso. But Yordanov wrestled the blade out of the man's hand and punched him in his masked face while holding his shirt. He felt two broad lines of pain suddenly spread across his back. Two other men had come from around the other corner and were beating his torso, arms, legs with steel bars. One blow struck the back of his head. He dropped the first man and started kicking back at the two others, but they quickly retreated into the dark. A fourth grabbed the incapacitated knife wielder and dragged him off hastily. Yordanov was too injured to follow and spent the next 2 days in the hospital, with dark internal hematomas covering his arms, legs, the top and back of his head, and spreading into violent wings on his shoulder blades. In Paris, Chobanov was working occasionally with Reporters Without Borders when he learned of the attack. He interviewed Yordanov by phone on behalf of the group, and the two became friends. They would later discover that Chobanov's grandparents had lived in the same neighborhood of Burgas as Yordanov's. Their grandfathers had once been in the same prisoner camp, and Chobanov's family had been one of the only ones to acknowledge Yordanov's grandmother's existence and visit her after Yordanov's grandfather's murder. Yordanov told Chobanov that he had no intention of caving to the thugs who had nearly killed him. In fact, he intended to take his journalistic independence even further. He wanted to launch his own news website, free of any corporate or government ties, and he wanted Chobanov, a computer-savvy reporter with a convenient geographic remove, to help him. They called it Beevil. And in its first months, the site had immediate impact. Rumiana Zhelova, Bulgaria's foreign minister, was set to be confirmed as a representative of the European Commission. Yordanov and Chobanov uncovered financial ties she had failed to disclose, showing that she continued to own a consulting company long after she had claimed to have no interests in it. The story kicked off an investigation of Zhelova that was picked up in foreign media, and finally led to her resignation from not only the EU post, but also her ministry position. Despite their early success, Chobanov could sense that Yordanov's traditional breed of muckraking was endangered. In September 2008, the journalist Ogonyan Stefanov had been stopped outside a Sofia restaurant one night and brutally beaten with hammers and steel bars, left for dead with broken arms and legs and a severe concussion that he barely survived. In this case, the attack had a new twist. The victim had attempted and failed to remain anonymous. Stefanov was secretly the editor of the blog Opasnite Novini, Dangerous News, that 10 days before had published a story based on a leak that showed officials in the new intelligence agency, DANS, were involved in a smuggling ring. DANS, whose name translates to National Security Agency, had been formed the same year, supposedly to fight organized crime. Somehow, it had identified Stefanov. In a government investigation that followed Stefanov's beating, and through more anonymous leaks to the press, Donce was revealed to be engaged in mass wiretapping of journalists and government officials. By 2010, the Bulgarian government would perform around 15,000 wiretaps annually, close to 200 times the number per capita reported in the United States that year. The mass surveillance and intimidation tactics of the communist-era Darjavna Sigurnost were alive and thriving. Chobanov knew that Bevel needed new ways to protect itself and its sources. So he simply typed anonymous submissions into Google. Soon he began to discover the cypherpunk's many gifts to journalists: PGP, off-the-record messaging, Tor, and WikiLeaks. The Bulgarian technophile was immediately fascinated by the site's technical methods and utter fearlessness. He began to monitor its leaks closely, and even experimented with uploading an unverified document that a source had sent him, in the hopes that this mysterious group might be able to authenticate it and publish it to a global audience. The document, written in Bulgarian, never surfaced on the site. It was only after the Cablegate release that Chobanov began to consider the full power of WikiLeaks' model, not just to protect journalism, but potentially to advance it. In a Skype chat with a few other journalists and technologists who worked on and off with Bevel, they proposed the idea of a leaking site that would publish locally focused documents that WikiLeaks wouldn't. A leaking syringe targeted at the Balkans and its neighbors, rather than a hose aimed at the world at large. Within days, they had registered the URL and set up an SSL-protected site and a Tor hidden service in an OVH data center in the French city of Roubaix, the same one that briefly housed WikiLeaks publications until they migrated to Sweden. To Chobanov and Yordanov's delight, the documents flowed in immediately, from the nuclear power agreement to the judicial bribery tapes. Solid, irrefutable primary source evidence obtained with cryptographic anonymity. But Chobanov was no Tim May, and BalkanLeaks wasn't Blacknet. The Bulgarian wasn't merely seeking to prove the power of cryptography and anonymity to slice through institutional secrecy. Like all good journalists, he and his colleagues were on the scent of the biggest possible stories, and they smelled them hidden deep in the still unpublished majority of the WikiLeaks cables, a trove of documents that, as Bradley Manning had promised, affected every country in the world. After the criticism WikiLeaks faced over its dump of the Afghanistan documents, the group had adopted a harm minimization policy that sought to redact the names of potential State Department informants or other sensitive individuals who might be endangered by exposure. That meant the small group was dependent on its relationships with media partners like The Guardian and The New York Times to dig through the immense collection of text and carefully redact names before the cables could be published. That painstaking process meant the leaks were flowing like molasses. By March, nearly 4 months after Cablegate began, only 5,000 of the 250,000 cables had appeared. WikiLeaks had put out a call on its Twitter feed for more media organizations to participate. Chobanov emailed a plea to a WikiLeaks contact to give the 978 cables from the embassy in Sofia to Bevel. No response. One released cable in particular had tantalized and galled Chobanov and Yordanov. It was a 2005 briefing by U.S. Ambassador James Pardue on the state of organized crime in Bulgaria and its extraordinarily cozy ties to government. But after the memo's redactions by WikiLeaks partners at The Guardian, it contained no specific names of Bulgarians. The Guardian had used the cable to construct a story on Russian influence in Bulgaria's mafia world, but hadn't been able to confirm any of the allegations against Bulgarians themselves. So the paper simply snipped huge portions of the text, mostly from a section titled, "Who's Who in Bulgarian Organized Crime?" Of the cable's original 5,226 words, all but 1,406 were missing. Luckily for Chobanov and Yordanov, WikiLeaks' control of the cables was itself beginning to spring leaks. One of the group's erstwhile partners, A freelance journalist and controversial Holocaust denier named Israel Shamir had obtained a portion of the unredacted cables and was using them to write stories for the Moscow magazine Russian Reporter. Chobanov wrote him an email in March asking about the contents of the Bulgarian cable. To his surprise, Shamir immediately responded with a full text. A few days after The Guardian's Bulgaria story, the Norwegian newspaper Aftenposten announced that it had also inexplicably gained access to the full set of cables. So Chobanov wrote to Aftenposten asking the paper's editors to verify the text that Shamir had sent them. They wrote back, confirming that Shamir's slice of the mega leak was the real deal. The unredacted cable was an encyclopedia of Bulgarian organized crime, with entries for every major group. Gangs with names like Multigroup, Intergroup, Tim, the Union of Former Commandos, and the Amigos. It cataloged their involvement in all flavors of crime, from tax fraud to smuggling, extortion to sexual slavery. It followed the flow of money to every major political party and named government officials who openly consorted with the groups or had made the transition from mafioso to politician. The cable named towns like Svilengrad and Velengrad that were controlled entirely by mafia cum government. Bevo published a story on the report titled simply Bulgarian Organized Crime Uncensored. Other Bulgarian newspapers picked up on the story. One, the paper Capital, headlined it simply, Black and White. The cable had confirmed in stark terms all the corruption that had been suspected for years. As usual, no one was indicted. Perhaps the strongest evidence of all of the government's symbiosis with criminals. For Beevil, the most important reaction came from WikiLeaks itself. The group published the unredacted version of the cable on its site, rather than the version of the cable that had been gutted by The Guardian, and accused the newspaper on its Twitter feed of cable cooking. Chobanov wrote to WikiLeaks again, suggesting that instead of The Guardian, the group hand all of its Bulgarian cables to Beevil. This time, WikiLeaks staff wrote back, asking for time to look into Beevil's background and to learn more about Chobanov and Yordanov. 2 months later, Chobanov received an email from his contact at WikiLeaks. He and Yordanov were invited to Ellingham Hall for a meeting with Julian Assange. Chobanov and Yordanov's first hours in England went badly. Yordanov left his laptop in an overhead bin on the airplane, and they spent hours trying to retrieve it from the airline. The Bulgarian pair got lost on the drive from London to Norfolk after Chobanov's GPS stopped working. And on one of the roundabouts, Chobanov forgot to drive on the left and caused a minor collision with an oncoming car. When they finally reached Ellingham, they found the WikiLeaks founder dressed in a gray suit and in a dour mood. He seemed preoccupied, Chobanov and Yordanov remember, with his legal fate and the financial industry's ongoing blockade choking donations to WikiLeaks. Assange also worried that the pair, like WikiLeaks' rogue partner Israel Shamir, might redistribute the cables willy-nilly, and had prepared a contract that held them responsible for redacting names of sensitive State Department sources before publishing the cables. It also stipulated that they only access the unredacted files from a computer with no internet connection. But Assange also praised BalkanLeaks, Yordanov and Chobanov told me. He said he had looked over the submission site's security and approved of its simple rigor. And he seemed to enjoy the homemade rakia that Yordanov had presented him as a gift. By the time we opened the second bottle, I knew that he would give us the documents, says Yordanov with a grin. They made arrangements to hand over the Bulgarian embassy files securely and returned home. When they accessed the full documents a month later, they found the wealth of scandals they had hoped for. One cable showed that Bulgarian officials in the United States had accumulated parking tickets totaling more than $400,000, so many that the United States had threatened to withhold nearly $500,000 in aid until they were paid. One cable listed all the Bulgarian banks that engaged in money laundering and corrupt loans. And then they came upon the greatest prize of all. a cable that dealt with the same subject Yordanov had first tackled 16 years earlier. Boyko Borisov, Bulgaria's prime minister. It was a 2006 memo from the U.S. ambassador in Sofia, John Byerly, on the subject of Borisov, predicting his run for the prime minister post, entitled Bulgaria's Most Popular Politician, Great Hopes, Murky Ties. The cable began by describing Borisov as implicated in serious criminal activity and maintaining close ties to Lukoil and the Russian embassy. It then tells Borisov's entire life story, starting with his youth as a neighborhood tough in a gang on the edges of Sofia, how he founded a private security firm and built it into one of the biggest in the country at a time when private security was synonymous with extortion and strong-arm tactics, as the cable reads. As chief secretary, he reportedly paid cash for positive press coverage and threatened journalists who criticized him. Then the cable comes to another section labeled The Dirt. Accusations in years past have linked Borisov to oil siphoning scandals, illegal deals involving Lukoil, and major traffic in methamphetamines. Borisov is alleged to have used his former position as head of Bulgarian law enforcement to arrange cover for criminal deals, and his common-law wife, Svetlana Borislavova, manages a large Bulgarian bank that has been accused of laundering money for organized criminal groups, as well as for Borisov's own illegal transactions. Borisov is said to have close social and business ties to influential mafia figures, including Mladen Mihalev, a.k.a. Macho, and is a former business partner of organized crime figure Rumen Nikolov, a.k.a. the Pasha. We should continue to push him in the right direction, the cable concludes, but never forget who we're dealing with. If a single document could ever be Bulgaria's Watergate, this was it. And two journalists from a news website that no one had ever heard of were about to publish it. A year after WikiLeaks released its collateral murder video, the first fruits of IMI appeared. Inspired by Jónsdóttir's lobbying, the Icelandic parliament passed a new media law that legally protected the anonymity of journalist sources, just as strongly as in Sweden. Under the law, Icelandic reporters aren't simply exempt from investigations that might reveal their sources. They're legally forbidden from identifying them. But even as IMI's information fortifications rose, Jónsdóttir discovered just how tough it's become to escape the long reach of the American government's war on anonymity. In early 2011, Jónsdóttir received a letter from Twitter Incorporated informing her that a government investigation had requested access to all of her data from the service, both public and private. In a sense, nothing about this was particularly unusual. Any internet service's data is fair game for law enforcement. In 2006, for instance, AOL revealed to the New York Times that it received about 1,000 such requests for its users' information from the government every month. 3 years later, when Facebook was still less than a third of the size it is now, one of its staffers told Newsweek that it was receiving 10 to 20 requests for data from law enforcement every day. Google, the only major technology company to formally publish statistics on those requests, reports that in the first half of 2011 alone, the government asked it to hand over user data 5,950 times, and that the company complied in 93% of those cases. The only fact that set Jónsdóttir's case apart from those thousands of others was that Twitter had even bothered to notify her about the government's snooping instead of silently acquiescing. Jónsdóttir contacted the lawyers at that cyber libertarian stalwart, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, who agreed to represent her in the legal fight to keep her private data private. Soon it was apparent she wasn't alone. The online information of Jacob Applebaum and Dutch WikiLeaks associate Rob Hongkrap, and likely Julian Assange and Bradley Manning, were all caught up in the same dragnet. The U.S. Department of Justice was searching for any scrap of incriminating communications related to WikiLeaks. Conversations between any of the group and Manning might be used to build a conspiracy case. And although Twitter had the courage to speak up about the government's probe, Yon's daughter's lawyers learned that four other unnamed companies had also quietly received requests for her data without alerting her. Together with Applebaum and Hongrap, Yon's daughter would spend the next year fighting the data requests in court, demanding that a judge unseal the rest of the secret investigation of their online activities. But in appeal after appeal, the courts ruled against them, declaring that users have no expectation of privacy on services like Twitter, even as they kept the investigation's own inner workings shrouded. Eventually, they would lose the legal battle, and their Twitter data, along with their personal information from several other unidentified services, would be handed over to investigators. When I speak to Yon's daughter about the case in the fall of 2011, she's surprisingly cheery. "I'm quite happy the American government has chosen to violate my privacy and make this an international diplomatic issue," she says. Better to go after a public figure and bring attention to the problem than let the cherry-picking of private individuals' data by the American government continue in secret, she says. Even so, the legal threats that have obtained her private data and prevented Yon's daughter from traveling to the United States since the investigation began represent a problem for IMI, too. The Internet doesn't reside in some abstract cyberspace of John Perry Barlow's gospel and Tim May's sci-fi imagining. Much of it, like Yon's daughter's Twitter data, resides in the United States. And until it physically moves to Iceland, it won't be protected by IMI's laws. As legal blogger Arthur Bright pointed out when IMI first surfaced, a media or technology company would have to relocate all of its staff and assets to Iceland, or face the reality that its people and property back at home would be subject to the same archaic media laws as always. Even if Iceland's laws offer the best protections in the world, there's still a Maginot line, Bright wrote. Yon's daughter is undeterred. Moving their entire staff and assets to Iceland, she argues, is exactly what companies ought to do. "I don't see why that's not a possibility," she muses, disregarding the sunless winters and relative isolation from the rest of humanity. But she helpfully offers another option. The United States could also repeal the Patriot Act and try democracy instead of tyranny. Changing the rest of the world's media laws isn't outside of Yon's daughter's endless ambition. She and Smára McCarthy, IMI's other champion, have been holding up Iceland as proof of concept for the rest of the world, meeting with free information advocates in Reykjavik and elsewhere to spawn nascent movements like the Irish Modern Media Initiative, the Italian Modern Media Initiative, and even one American Indian woman in Berkeley, California, who hopes to use an Indian reservation's legal protections as the basis for a data transparency haven within America's own borders. Like WikiLeaks before it, Yon's daughter sees IMI as just another piece of a grander, global alchemy of change. These things are just drops in one big wave. That wave is just one wave in a river, she says. And I don't know where that river is going to take us. In December 2010, just as the first rounds of WikiLeaks State Department cables were metastasizing around the internet, I spoke with Evgeny Morozov, a Belarusian academic and writer with a famously pessimistic attitude toward the internet's ability to democratize global politics. Instead, he believes digital tools have only tightened governments' control over their citizens. I ask him about WikiLeaks and whether it might be an exception to his rule. He thinks not. Information can embarrass governments, but you have to look at the nature of governments as well as the nature of information to measure this embarrassment factor, he answers. In Russia or China, he specifies, corruption is already an open secret. Just go and take photos of their villas and their summer houses they buy with their state salaries, he says. It's already in the open. But exposure by itself in these countries doesn't lead to democratic change. And what about BalkanLeaks, the Bulgarian site that at that time was just starting to get its hands on some juicy documents? Bulgaria is a subject Morozov knows well. He studied for several years at Sofia's American University. I don't know what information you could publish to embarrass the Balkans. It's a tough one, he says. There's an environment that's so suffused with cynicism toward politicians that to me it's hard to imagine what kind of stuff would need to be leaked. In May 2011, BalkanLeaks put that cynicism to the test. It published the words of the U.S. ambassador that labeled Bulgaria's prime minister a criminal several times over. The news reverberated around the country's blogs and was written up in several newspapers. And then, as Morozov predicted, very little happened. In a display of frantic backpedaling, the U.S. Embassy in Sofia released a statement backing Borisov. While we cannot comment on the content of alleged classified materials which may have been leaked, we would like to underscore that the U.S. and Bulgaria share an excellent relationship and that our high level of bilateral cooperation speaks for itself. Borisov himself angrily told one reporter who asked about his ties to Lukoil that, "I do not read WikiLeaks," and will not comment on yellow press publications. Soon, the usual politics kicked in. The opposition party demanded a probe into the accusations. Borisov's own party emphasized that the report's release was an underhanded move timed to coincide with local elections. The country's top prosecutor, Boris Velchev, refused to pursue the case. If we allow an investigation to be opened on mere allegations, can you imagine what country we would be turning into? He asked rhetorically. Borisov, it seemed, had emerged with hardly a scratch. A few months after that mini-scandal, I asked Chobanov if he's satisfied with the results of his leaks. "Yes, I am quite satisfied with the impact," he answers without hesitation. Several judges have been pushed out by various means since BalkanLeaks reports on bribery in the Masonic Lodge, what he sees as internal house cleaning. And since the cable publication on the country's prime minister, Borisov hasn't been invited to meet with any other European leaders one-on-one, he says. They don't want to be seen shaking hands with an Armani-clad tough guy, as the U.S. ambassador once secretly described him in a memo. The former Minister of Defense and two other officials exposed in BalkanLeaks' early wiretapping transcripts have been charged with bribery, and their prosecution is ongoing. Others, like the prosecutor blackmailed by Angil Donchev and another who pressured a witness to change his testimony in a real estate case, haven't been charged with crimes. On a larger scale, the leaks may have also contributed to a decision by the Netherlands and Finland to veto Bulgaria's accession to the EU's visa-free Schengen travel zone based on concerns about organized crime, a clear sign from Bulgaria's neighbors that it must clean up its mafia taint. But didn't Chobanov hope that the cable about Borisov would lead to his resignation? The soft-spoken Bulgarian asks for patience. He says that the full influence of the report still isn't clear. It's a slow process. With the Pentagon Papers, nothing happened at first. But eventually, there was Watergate, he says. First, they ignore it. Then they fight it. Then they finally accept it as evidence. I offer the adage attributed to Mahatma Gandhi. First they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win. No, Chobanov responds without looking at me. Sometimes you lose. On my last day in Varvara, Chobanov, Yordanov, and a group of friends invite me to go sailing in the Black Sea on a small boat with Moby Dick written on its side in Cyrillic. We drop anchor in a shallow cove with an isolated beach in the distance, populated by only a single tent and a pirate flag planted in the sand. As Chobanov plays with his two squealing children, I swim over to an outcropping of volcanic rock 50 feet away, and Yordanov follows me. We admire a few of the dead Medusa jellyfish floating in the tidal pools. "Very beautiful," Yordanov says. Then he points off in the distance to a complex of unfinished four-story buildings on a cliff beside the beach. Modern structures with diagonally expanding floors that lean out over the sea, with a round, bare concrete tower at their center. Yordanov explains that a story he wrote for Politica exposed what would have been a luxury apartment development there as illegal construction, part of the series of investigations that led to the knife attack on him in Burgas. The news resulted in a government order to halt the construction we're looking at. If not for that story, he says, the beach below would have been developed as private land. I'm very proud my investigations can save this beach, says Yordanov. I'm very proud of my work. Since Yordanov's expose, the apartment's massive concrete skeleton has been left to rot. No one is allowed to finish building it, but no one has bothered to remove its carcass either. It stands instead as an enormous concrete acropolis, a monument to a country caught between its impulse to develop and the corruption it can't escape. As we climb back into the Moby Dick and sail toward Vivara, the newly constructed ruins loom over us from the cliff face and then recede into the distance.